Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good day, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Campbell soup can, sculptures made of Brillo boxes, double Capote portraits. Make no mistake, Andy Warhol is one of the most recognizable artists of the 20th century. He made art that even non-patrons of the art world encountered on a regular basis. And yet, hard as it is to believe, Warhol had not had a full career retrospective in the U.S. in more than three decades. But all that changes this week with the opening of Andy Warhol From A to B and Back Again, a monumental exhibit that just opened at the Whitney on Monday and runs through March 31st before moving on to Chicago and San Francisco. The exhibit is curated by the Whitney's Donna DeSalvo, and she joins us in studio. Welcome, Donna.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
By the way.
Thank you.
I went yesterday. And it was just, it's enormous. It's expansive. The crowd is worth watching as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah, there's a lot of social anthropology going on. It's interesting. And it's a visual feast, which is very Warhol.
And you know what else very Warhol? I looked to my left and I saw a member of the Kardashian clan. And I looked to my right and I saw a correspondent from PBS NewsHour.
Oh my gosh,
and I thought,
wow.
This is Warhol.
That's Warhol's world.
What were your goals in curating this exhibit?
Sure. Well, you know, it was really an attempt to bring some clarity, I think, to an artist who's so profusive, made so much work, that in a way it's almost impossible in a certain way to grapple with it all. But also to sort of situate the work and its development over the course of Warhol's career and see his experiences as a commercial illustrator when he first comes to New York, as well as, you know, how Warhol is really grappling with the fundamental problems of art making. And that's often lost in so much of the discussion that has happened during Warhol's era when he was alive, and even after he died, as just the man with the funny wig who went to a lot of parties. And he's so much more than that.
He was so prolific. In deciding what would be in this exhibit, how did you make your choices, and how did you decide to organize it?
Sure. Well, you know, I think, first of all, I decided that the best thing was to do it largely chronologically, because it's the way to track, in a sense, the development of Warhol's thinking, his ideas. And there are certain key works that you just can't imagine a Warhol retrospective without. The 32 Campbell soup cans from the Museum of Modern Art, or the Marilyn diptych, you know, from the Tate, or Nine Jackies from the Whitney's own collection. So they're just sort of key works. And I had done a show years ago on the 50s called Success is a Job in New York at the Gray Art Gallery that was of the commercial work. So I knew a lot of that work. The hardest thing, of course, is there's so much really, really great work. And, you know, I had certain feelings about certain works that just do certain things. And so I had to be very judicious in making those decisions about either introducing a new idea, a new paradigm shift, or that show how Warhol engages with color and then re-engages with it. And also painting, hand painting. And a lot of that you see in the early days of the 60s, but then again in the 70s and 80s when Warhol's career had fallen off. And then throw on top of that film, photography, video, publishing, television. It's tough, but it's one of the challenges that you live for as a curator.
I'm sure. I want to talk about a couple of the pieces that I didn't know that well and I think are really interesting. Ladies and Gentlemen, mm-hmm. from 1975. It's one of his few portraitures where we don't know the identities necessarily,
right,
of the people,
right,
and that they're anonymous for a reason.
Yes.
Will you tell people about this?
Sure. So he was approached by a dealer in Italy to do a series of portraits of, the term would be used then, of drag queen or trans people. And he did not want the superstars of the factory, Candy Darling. He didn't want them. And so Warhol went on a search with his friend Bob Colicello to find sitters. And he went to a New York club called the Gilded Grape, where there were a lot of drag performers. And they were each asked to pose, they didn't know they were posing for Warhol. They got paid a very little amount of money, like $50. And Warhol made Polaroids of them, which we then translated into photographs. Now, it's interesting because when he showed them, they were called Ladies and Gentlemen. And there are very few paintings where Warhol also features people of color. And so in our showing of them, and others have done even earlier than us, we've actually included the names because we know who they are. Mm-hmm. They signed the Polaroids. And one of them in particular is Marsha P. Johnson, who was a very leading figure in the gay rights movement, very involved with Stonewall, Wilhelmina Ross, who had a band. So it's interesting.
How much times have changed.
Luckily.
Yes.
Luckily. And I think we're sensitized to, you know, saying, well, they're not just anonymous individuals. You know, and it's part of the complexity of Warhol and the different circles in which he moved and those he didn't move within. Mm-hmm. They're also introduced color in an amazing way. And there's a great essay in the catalog by the artist Glenn Ligon, who really talks about that, who speaks from the perspective as an African-American man and artist of colored and color. Mm-hmm. And really, you see Warhol with these exuberant colors, and the poses are kind of amazing to see these individuals who were performers and full of life in these portraits. So it's an incredible series, and there are hundreds of them. We only have a small selection, but we have one that's really large scale that's fantastic.
There's also his first ever public artwork.
The Most Wanted Men?
Yes, The Most Wanted Men. When was it created and what for?
Well, he made it for the New York State Pavilion of the World's Fair. So Philip Johnson, the architect, designed the pavilion, and he commissioned a number of artists, many of the pop artists, Roy Lichtenstein, Klaus Oldenburg, along with Ellsworth Kelly, to make works for the facade of the pavilion. And Warhol was decided that he would use these images taken from a New York City police bulletin of individuals wanted for crimes. And he silkscreened them onto a huge canvas, and they were put on the facade of the pavilion. Now, fair organizers weren't so happy about this. They thought that they were perhaps not the image they should project into the fair and family friendly. They asked him to submit something else. He wanted to have a portrait of Robert Moses, the great either destroyer or maker of New York. Obviously, he's a contentious figure. And they said no. So he painted them over in silver. And that was it. He also made a film series called The 13 Most Beautiful Boys. So this is where you see these dual mm-hmm. aspects of Warhol. And I still think it's an incredibly outrageous thing to have put at the World's Fair at that period of time. This is pre-Stonewall. It's a very different time. But not everybody got that reading of it.
Mm-hmm.
People knew who were in the know. Anyway, that's why, and they're the anti-hero. They're the complete opposite of what, you know, you would have expected. But it's why it's such an incredible series.
We're speaking with Donna DeSalvo. She curated the Andy Warhol Show from A to B and Back Again, which is currently at the Whitney. It just opened up. There is the Death and Disaster series as well, which really you get a sense of how obsessed he was with media and headlines. Mm-hmm. In terms of this series, how does it fit into his whole career?
Sure. Well, it's a very important series, and it's often seen as one of his pivotal series of works. I mean, he was obsessed with media because we're obsessed with media. So he was reflecting in a sense the cultural desire for news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, spectacle and tragedy, sadly, sells. So he picked up on that. So many of the images were discarded from AP Wire Photo or UPI because they were too gruesome. Some of them actually appeared in magazines. So he was going to do a show in Paris, which he was going to call Death in America. And these were that's where they were first shown. So you have images of car crashes, suicides, and you have some where they're really speaking to historical moments. So the Mustard Race Riot, which uses the famous Charles Moore photograph of the civil rights protest in Birmingham, where the protesters are attacked by dogs. Or there's one of two women who die as a result of eating tainted tuna fish. They die botulism, you know. Or you also have a suicide of a woman who's fallen from jumped from the Empire State Building. Some of these appeared in Life magazine. Some of them never made it because they were so gruesome. But I think what you see there is you move from celebrity to this anonymous, because these are we don't know who these mm-hmm. people are. And it also gives you the darker side of Warhol's whole project. You know, there's a dark side to Warhol. There's a dark side to consumption, to overconsumption. And also, look, there's a base instinct that attracts us to looking at some of these images. You know, we're bombarded with them. And, you know, Warhol grows up in the age of radio. TV comes into the picture like mid-50s. Mm-hmm. So we're more and more, that culture, that time, people are looking at images far more. And they're the great pictorial magazines, Life, look, as well as New York Post, Daily Mirror. Some of these things don't even exist anymore. So the picture became the language, and we're in it even more today.
I think about that sometimes as I was walking through. I thought, what about if Andy Warhol were alive during the internet?
Yes.
It sort of makes your head spin.
Yeah,
he's
a pre-digital guy.
Yeah, it's an amazing thought. There's also some very interesting behind the scenes, almost like quotidian pictures of him vacuuming
yes.
a gallery where he's going to have a show. Why was it important to have that be part of the
show?
Well,
that's actually a work of art. So he, because I think that when Warhol was shot in 1968 by Valerie Solanas, who had written a book called Scum, The Society for Cutting Up Men, and she was very unhappy with Warhol. He promised to produce one of her screens into a movie. It didn't happen, and she shot him, and he was it was a near fatal mm-hmm. shooting. He comes, has a period of convalescence. You know, oftentimes people think this is when Warhol's work declines. And what you see through some of these experiments in this period of 68 to 72 are actually how fertile his mind is. And I believe you learn a lot from an artist by seeing the works that actually never make the quote unquote big time, because they show the process. You know, it's never A to Z.
Right.
It's A to B, A to Z, A to D, mm-hmm. back and forth. And so that gallery, that's actually a project he was asked to do for a women's college that doesn't exist anymore called Finch College.
Right? Yeah.
And he, along with a number of other artists, were invited to do projects in the gallery. So what does he do? Something so simple, as you say, so quotidian. He vacuums the gallery. It's documented, and he leaves behind the bag of dirt. So all that exists. And I just think it shows him as a conceptual artist, shows him as humor,
yeah.
shows him as also looking at almost kind of emptiness and nothingness, which is, you know, a serious read, serious and funny simultaneously.
There's also one of these time capsules.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he do those?
So they start from a very pragmatic place. They were moving factories, moving the studio. He had all this junk that people sent him, you know, fan letters, invitations, all kinds of things. So it started very practically. Vincent Fremont, who worked with him for many years, they just got these boxes and he started packing things away. At a certain point, he just systematizes it. So there's 660 of these time capsules, and they just have an array of things. And I think they're so great because they might be the kind of thing you might find in an archaeological
mm-hmm.
dig someday. And we have one on display from the period around 1972, 73, and they're fan letters, Christmas cards, things from Yves Saint Laurent, artists like Ray Johnson. It runs the gamut from the famous to the unknown. Some of them are their books. Apparently they opened a time capsule at the Andy Warhol Museum that had a birthday cake that wasn't eaten. So you get the sense of the stream and the flow of culture. And in a way, that's the source
mm-hmm.
for so much of what Warhol brings into all aspects of his art.
We're speaking with Donna DeSalvo. She curated Andy Warhol from A to B and back again, which is currently at the Whitney. Where do we see his background? He's Andy Warhol. He grew
yes.
up Catholic. Where do we see this in the show?
Sure. Well, there's an early room in the exhibition where actually there are only a few pieces from his time when he was a student at the Carnegie Institute of Technology, now Carnegie Mellon. And one of them is from a class assignment for social observation. And he elects to to make a painting of his family's living room. And you see this very lived-in home. It's a crucifix on the mantelpiece.
Mm-hmm.
The furniture is, you know, kind of slightly looks hand-me-down, full of character. But I think what you see there is the evidence of Warhol before Warhol. He's a kid from a working class immigrant background. His parents are from Czechoslovakia. His father was a coal miner. He's the first in his family to graduate college. He uses the name Warhola, and which is the family name. He eventually drops off the A to become Warhol. And I think, you know, and he's a gay kid growing up in Pittsburgh. So I think it sets the stage for how Warhol is both an insider and an outsider. He has a great desire to be famous. He loves writing away to movie stars, to getting their pictures. As I said, he's a child of radio. So there's an imagination. That's why I love mm-hmm. radio, because it really keeps the imagination really sharp. And he, you know, has this aspiration. And it's the story of many people who come to New York to make their fortune. So I think there's that's the human side of Warhol. And it's very difficult, I think, for someone who created a brilliant persona, his invention, wore the funny wigs, all the things that make it very difficult to actually see Warhol as an artist who, you know, had to make a living. I mean, he wasn't going to, he knew this romantic idea that, you know, artists could just make art and not worry about making a living was just a fantasy. So he's a hard worker, and as is all of his family. Yeah. Years ago, I traveled to Pittsburgh and I met his brothers, and his nephew, Jamie Warhol, participated through loans to the show. And it's very interesting, of course, to see very different sides, you know, for many people who move from their, leave their family and move to another city. And there's a relationship, but not. You're living a completely different life in certain ways. And that's when you go to Pittsburgh. I think you also, as yeah. you said, you had gone to Pittsburgh. You see that because it's one of the great American cities. So I think it comes out, and it's evident in that gallery of the 50s. You don't really see it again in quite the same way. And that's why it was so important to, for a variety of reasons, but that's one of the reasons I included those works in the exhibition.
There's a great kids book called Uncle Andy's
that's
Cats.
That's by Jamie Warhol, his
yeah.
nephew.
Yes. I read it to my son all the time. It's yep. one of my favorite books because it really does give you an insight to Andy Warhol in a different way.
It's a kid's perspective yeah. because he was growing up around Uncle Andy.
It's a great book, by the way, for folks, if you've got a kid out there. I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's so much different kind of medium in this. We've got silk screens, you've got video, you've got film, you've got painting. Was it, when you think about his career, is there one form of medium you think is quintessential Warhol?
I guess it would have to be the paintings, because it is, for all the greatness, and the film, I have to say, it's painting and film. It's hard to say, because his films are very revolutionary and very important. You know, that's a body of work that roughly is from 63 to the late 60s. And his paintings, because that's really, they're radical in rethinking what a painting could be. And, you know, one of the great joys, I have a young team of colleagues I've worked with, Mark Luacano, Christy Mitchell, and Lauren Young, and they're a very different generation. And I have to say, it's been really fascinating to get their insight, you know, about Warhol and what they connect to. And some of it was in the film, some of it's his TV programs that he did. And then, of course, the paintings. So the different types of media really work in different ways. And they're also coming from a digital background. So they have a very interesting connection. They see the painting through, in some ways, the history of art, but also the lens of the digital.
That's so interesting. You figure you've got people who are in their early 30s who don't know anything about that, him as a living artist.
Yes. Well, you know, the last Warhol retrospective was in 1989.
At MoMA, right?
Yeah. Yes. So a lot of the number of people that aren't born in 1989.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they also have the same bias against Warhol as the guy who couldn't paint, the guy who had the factory. That's all fascinating part of his persona and a kind of spin that he did to almost, I would say, puncture this romantic idea of the artist, because he's coming out of 50s, abstract expressionism, Mark Rothko, Jackson. That's the milieu, too. And, you know, I think that they, in some ways, I've learned a lot from them, because they have an immediate, they get something very immediate about Warhol's work. And I do think it's what's allowed Warhol's work to transcend the 20th and into the 21st century. And it's one of the things I'm really very gratified with this exhibition. And I hope it actually now informs a new generation. Which is what any artist wants. Last thing you want is to be forgotten and be
irrelevant.
Or be irrelevant. And I think he remains incredibly relevant. And really, many of those works feel very now. Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain. I know that's not a very technical term, but they feel very present.
I would say plan a good 2 or 3 hours if you're going to go.
It's a big show.
It's a big show.
True.
The show is called Andy Warhol From A to B and Back Again. It is at the Whitney now through March 2019. Thank you so much, Donna DeSalvo. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next on All of It, we'll get an overview of Work It, WNYC's podcast festival, and we'll hear from the author of a New Yorker piece about the podcast culture of binge listening. Stay with us. We will be right back. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Work It is a women's podcast festival and is currently in the middle of a week of events hosted by our very own WNYC Studios. Featuring voices like Ellen Horn, former EP of Radiolab, a live event with the Harvard Business Review's podcast, Women at Work, and Hillary Frank of The Longest Shortest Time, the festival aims to elevate women and non-binary identifying individuals in the pursuit of audio narrative making. Here to talk a bit about the aims of the festival and the upcoming live show taping of NPR's Code Switch at the Apollo as part of the festival is Jennifer Sendro. She's the executive producer of The Green Space. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
You are busy and tired, so thank you so much for coming by.
I am. I feel like a shell of a person, but a really happy shell.
So how did this festival start? What was the original idea?
We started in 2015, and it came about because at that time, only about 20% of the podcasts in the top 100 on iTunes had women's voices on the mic, which seems crazy because we are half the population and we're a huge chunk of the podcast listening audience. So our goal was to get women together and inspire them to educate each other, lift each other up, make connections, mentor each other to change that. And we have. We're up about 40% now of the iTunes 100 podcasts have women as co-hosts or hosts. And here at WNYC Studios, we're almost at 45% now, mm-hmm. So we're getting there.
How did the word first get out about Work It? I mean, it was its first year, and you said there weren't that many women in podcasting. How did you get the word out?
The first year we did it here in the green space at WNYC, so it's a really intimate space. We only had about 100 women there, and we invited them. We reached out to women that we knew and asked them to come and join us. The second year we were in the green space again, but we opened it up to applications, and we found that 700 women wanted to come.
Wow.
So then we knew we needed a bigger venue. So last year we were in Los Angeles in downtown LA, and we had 600 women come out. And this year we just had 600 women here in New York. We met in Queens at the Knockdown Center. We had women from 30 states and 13 countries come in, which was amazing. We had 80 women presenting on our stages, half of them women of color, and we covered all aspects of the creative side of podcasting as well as the business side, along with a lot of real talk about what it's like to avoid burnout at work, mm-hmm. and be a working mom and be a woman entrepreneur and how do you fund a business? All the good, the bad, and the ugly of getting what you want in your work life as a podcaster.
My friend who's a Fancy Pants executive at Spotify has been to all four, and she said she thought this was the most diverse, and she really felt like she got the most out of this one.
Yeah.
Just letting you know, a little feedback.
It was pretty awesome. A big part of what we do, too, beyond just the programming on stage, is the mentoring. We matched 150 women with mentors, mm-hmm. and we hope that that keeps this community going beyond just a Facebook group, beyond just a directory on a Google Doc. Actually making those one-to-one connections is huge for us.
All right. So I've been listening, and I've been hearing the ads for it, thinking, how did this come about? The idea of Code Switch doing a live performance taping at the Apollo.
Yeah, well, it's one of our favorite shows, and this is the first year that we decided we were going to have some male co-hosts join us at Work It because we need the men, too. We got to have the men supporting
the
women. And Gene Demby, total feminist, rocking guy. Like, why not have Code Switch in the mix? We also had our show, Nancy, did a taping. Mm-hmm. Tobin Lowe and Nancy and Kathy, too, did a Nancy typing this week at the Bell House. So the show at the Apollo is really exciting. It's our biggest one, our biggest venue at the festival, and their guests are Marcus Samuelson, who's a chef. They have Ashley Nicole Black, comedian, Bobby Sanabria, performing music. It's going to be really, really hot.
What's the challenge of putting something like that together?
All the things. We have 12 events.
All the things.
I know.
All of it?
I know, everything. We have 12 events this week across three boroughs.
Wow.
At eight different venues. So we have a lot going on. We have events in the green space. There's still tickets for a few of these, too. So if people want to join us, they can go to workitevents.com and see the full schedule. And of course, if you missed some earlier in the week, they're all going to be podcasts. So you can go and listen to what you didn't attend.
That's right. And Monday night, I introduced Krista Tippett and Claudia Rankin.
Yeah.
I heard that was
amazing. I was moving chairs around across town.
So, you know, we're going to our next guest is a writer from The New Yorker. And she wrote this piece, which I understand a lot of people were talking about at Work It, about some of the ethical considerations of podcasting. Did that come up at all in any of your panels or just even in informal conversations?
Oh, huge. I mean, we had a panel called Who Tells the Story of Our Future? And we also had a few different journalism panels in which we talked a lot about how responsible you are for the stories that you tell and how you tell them and where you situate yourself in those stories. I think it's something that people are really conscious about right now.
I think especially after anybody who saw it Saturday Night Live last week. Yeah. Where they had the Potty Awards, the podcast awards.
Yeah.
And I think one of the categories was places that podcasters where white women shouldn't go. And it was like to the El Chapo trial, like just these, this idea of people just inserting themselves into situations that maybe they, you know, aren't being most culturally sensitive to.
Absolutely. I think people want to do their best work. And I feel like part of what we're trying to do at Work It is for people to really hear each other and consider more than just what they're doing in their little bubble. Because, yeah, you know, we're sitting here in a room talking into two tubes in a little soundproof box. And that's what podcasting can be. So getting 600 women together who are interested in shaping the future of this medium and storytelling beyond it, really, it's a powerful opportunity to kind of look each other in the eyes and have honest conversations about what we do and how we do it.
And it's great. It sounds like it's something I think is really necessary. So congratulations. Knock wood, tomorrow night goes off.
Thank you. They have to give you the day off next time so you can come.
I know. I would love to come. I will be part of it next year. I promise. Jennifer Sandro is the executive producer of The Green Space. She was here to talk to us about Work It. Go get some rest, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You are listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. And if you're listening to me right now, you might be listening to me live, or maybe you've downloaded the podcast of this show. How many times have you been asked recently, what podcast are you listening to? The question of how this form became so popular is the subject of a new article in the November 19th issue of The New Yorker out now. Titled Binge Listening, Rebecca Mead, a staff writer at the magazine, probes the origins of the podcast form and how it's the way it is having an impact on the way we perceive truth and the marriage of information and the narrative form. And I'm happy to welcome Rebecca Mead to All of It. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So you begin and you also end your article by referring to the philosopher Walter Benjamin, his thoughts on how information and news, what the impact of these two things are on storytelling. Can you explain to us how he saw one influencing the other?
Well, I became very interested in the phenomenon, really the idea of storytelling, which has sort of become a buzzword, hasn't it, over the last few years. You'll have journalists saying, well, I'm not really a journalist, I'm a storyteller, I'm a person who tells stories. And I became just very interested in the kind of spread of that idea and to what extent that might be different from what we would think of as conventional news gathering. And so that's what I set about to explore in this piece, sort of the broader ethics and aesthetics of storytelling.
Your article focuses a lot on the moral and ethical gray areas around storytelling and how podcasts treat their subjects and their subject matter. Specifically, you talk a lot about a podcast called Missing Richard Simmons, which I confess I listened to the whole thing. But Richard Simmons wasn't technically missing. Can you explain in what ways this podcast is a little problematic or at least exemplary of some of the ethical and moral issues at hand?
Yeah, it was a fascinating podcast. I, too, listened to it. But I listened to it with a kind of sort of queasy sense while I was listening to it of whether I really should be or not. The podcast, for those of your listeners who haven't listened to it, was a sort of investigation of why Richard Simmons, the diet guru, had vanished from public view. And the host, Dan Taberski, who's a very engaging person to be listening to, went in pursuit of Richard Simmons, whom he knew, and tried to track him down and tried, if not to find him, which he didn't end up being able to do, not to speak with him, to sort of sort through and sift through the stories and the theories of why it was that he had disappeared. Now, Pineapple Street Media, which is the company that I focus on in my article, and who produced that podcast. You know, when that podcast was first released, they told me they didn't expect it to have a huge listenership. What happened was that people got hooked and the audience grew very, very rapidly. And all of a sudden, you know, there were millions of people wondering what happened to Richard Simmons. So there was a sense in listening to it that there was a sort of hounding of a person who'd really just opted out of being in the public eye. And whether it was legitimate or not for us as listeners to sort of enter into this pursuit was part of what made the podcast so fascinating to listen to. It was our own complicity in that kind of quest was part of why people were so drawn to it.
Do you think there is or should there be more wiggle room for truth and narrative in podcasts as opposed to traditional news media?
Well, I don't think podcasters set out to tell anything other than the truth. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the most successful podcasts of our age are all, you know, setting out to deceive us. I don't think that's the case at all. But I think that there is a difference. There's a difference when what is being attempted is to tell a yarn, tell a story that will keep people coming back, episode after episode. Listening not incidentally to the advertisements for Casa mattresses or whatever it is that are being interspersed through the podcast. There's a difference there than just telling us the facts that are discovered at the end of the inquiry.
One of the podcasts you also write about is S-Town, which became immensely popular, but it had some of its own difficulties after it became so popular. Among them, the podcast was sued by the subject's family.
That's right. I mean, I think S-Town is a fascinating, it's not even a typical example, because I think it's a really a sort of extraordinary accomplishment, actually. And I think that what makes it as extraordinary as it is the ways in which it in some ways diverges from what the established podcast tropes had been up until then. It was very, very literary. It's very, very shaped. It's the kind of thing that rewards a second or third listening, not just, you know, a gobbling up the first time through and then you're done with it. But, you know, it focused upon the life of an individual who committed suicide during the period during which the podcast was being reported. And then the podcast becomes something else, and it becomes a story about this individual's life and some aspects of his private life that he hadn't necessarily wanted to be made public. So, again, when listening to it, one has moments of thinking, huh, I don't know whether I should be listening to this story. I think that is an instance where the achievement, the artistic achievement of the podcast itself is so extraordinary that the accomplishment is worth whatever transgression is involved in there. As was the case with has been the case with sort of true life narratives that have been told in all kinds of other media before this one.
We're speaking with Rebecca Mead, staff writer at The New Yorker, about her piece in the November 19th issue about binge listening and podcasts. What kind of challenges are coming up now that podcasts have become money, big money? People are making movies out of podcasts. People's lives are being sold that weren't necessarily, I mean, the podcasts don't necessarily own the stories to these people's lives, do they?
Well, it depends from story to story. I mean, I don't know the details of everybody's podcast deal, but, there are different levels of commitment involved in the central subject of these stories or not. It has become a tremendously important source of what the movie industry would call intellectual property. And there are, you know, TV companies and movie companies are looking very, very hard at the podcast space to come up with material and come up with stories to turn into other forms of media. It's much cheaper to make a 10-episode podcast series, which can be made for about $500,000, than it is to spend $5 million making a TV pilot for a show. So if you're a creative entity and you want to come up with a sort of test an idea, you can make a podcast and see how it goes, and then maybe turn it into a movie, turn it into a Netflix series, turn it into something else entirely.
I know in my Twitter feed, I keep getting video promotions for Dear John, starring Connie Britton, which started as a podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's Homecoming, which is which also started out as a podcast, and we've now got Julia Roberts appearing in that. So, you know, there are very, very exciting things being done. And, you know, coming into the world as a journalist, as a print journalist, and coming and talking to all these people who are in that world, there's a tremendous amount of excitement and optimism and energy, which is sort of fantastic to be around, and creativity and new ways of thinking about putting stories in front of the public.
In this piece, you spent some time with the folks at Pineapple Street Media. They're one of the podcast production companies. There's several of them. But you do write that This American Life, good old-fashioned terrestrial radio show, probably had the most influence on narrative podcasting. Why?
There is nothing that has had more influence than This American Life. And there's nobody who's had more influence than Ira Glass on this whole phenomenon of audio storytelling. And part of that is because many of the people who are now making waves in podcasts are people who sort of came up in that shop. They learned at Ira's knee. You know, so there's a lot of what he developed, the ways of telling a story in a very intimate way, either with him telling the story or with one of his correspondents telling the story, and showing the personality of the reporter and showing maybe the stumblings of the reporter and the questions of the reporter and the ways in which the reporter is, you know, it's just a fallible human being, not an all-knowing sort of authoritative voice. You know, those things were very, very new when Ira Glass started doing them in the early days of This American Life. And that show continues to be one of the best listened to and one of the best podcasts there is.
This brings me to a question which I've always struggled with when I listen to podcasts, and I started in podcasting a long time ago, way back machine, 10 years ago, is, and as I listen, there, I'm troubled by faux naivete. When I hear people who I think, you work at a very large, prestigious institution, and if you don't know the answer to that question or are shocked by it, I'm not sure how you're employed by that large, prestigious institution. I mean, is there a certain issue with the performance aspect, especially in the newsier podcasts?
Well, I think that there has definitely been this kind of informality that has developed in podcasting. And, you know, you see it in something like The Daily, which is the New York Times' podcast, which I think is fantastic and really, really interesting and kind of a great way to get a hit on of news at the beginning of the day. But there's a way in which it shows the reporters of the New York Times to be just ordinary human beings, just trying to do their job, trying to find out the story, maybe don't know the story completely yet. You know, and Michael Barbaro, who is one of the creators of that show and is the host of that show, told me that from his perspective, doing that kind of behind the scenes reveal was in direct response to the failure, in a way, of the mainstream media in the 2016 election to tell the story as it turned out to be, and this kind of appearance of authority that ended up being, you know, we all discovered wrong. So I think that, you know, there's a hesitancy too, isn't there, on the part of people who are in the mainstream media to kind of assert authority in the current climate, and maybe adopting a position of kind of faux naivete is a kind of useful defensive tool.
You end your piece with an interesting, it's not exactly a warning, but it's just an interesting thing to consider. You wrote, sometimes a narrative can satisfy because it is beguiling, but not because it is true. Do you think this is something in particular as podcasts move forward that possibly should be printed out and put on a wall somewhere?
Please feel free. I mean, I, you know, everybody loves a good story. I was writing specifically there about a podcast that pineapple made for Hillary Clinton. They weren't doing it as objective reporters. They were doing it as a piece of work for hire for the Clinton campaign. But it told the story of what was expected to be Hillary Clinton's ascent to the presidency. And the final episode before the election was a kind of very intimate conversation with Hillary about what would her mother have felt had she seen her about to become the first president of the United States. And it was very touching and completely wrong, as it turned out. And so there was a way in which, had you just listened to that podcast, you might have been lured into thinking, well, you know, this is inevitable. There's a way that stories can be told that will make their outcome seem inevitable. And I think we all need to be wary of those of that trap and keep our wits about us.
You can read Rebecca Mead's piece, Binge Listening, in the November 19th issue of The New Yorker. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All of It will be back after a quick break with the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the website, The Infatuation. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Joining me now in studio is Chris Stang. He is CEO and co-founder of The Infatuation. Also joining me is Hillary Reinsberg, editor-in-chief of The Infatuation, who was recently named one of Forbes 30 Under 30. So at this point, you're wondering, what is The Infatuation? It's a website and an app that's chock full of bar and restaurant recommendations and reviews with occasionally cheeky curated guides, rating-based reviews, and a text-back service. We'll get them to explain that in a minute. Chris, Hillary, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So Chris, what is the origin story of The Infatuation?
So yeah, you know, we started in 2009, so we're almost 10 years old, though it was not, I think, what I would call a company to start. It was basically a thing that Andrew, my co-founder and good friend and business partner, started when we were in the music business. So I worked at Atlantic Records, Andrew worked at Warner Brothers Records, and, you know, we both were passionate about food and restaurants, and the music business is a nighttime sport, so you end up going out a lot and learning about the restaurants of New York City. It helped that we also had corporate cards so we could afford to eat in places.
What are those?
Yeah, exactly.
Do they exist anymore?
Right. But, you know, as we were sort of, you know, learning about New York and figuring the city out, we realized that our friends were looking for sort of situational restaurant recommendations, meaning that they would always ask us for advice on where to go on a first date or where to take their parents when they are in town. And rather than sort of finding that information elsewhere, we just found that they were coming to us. So as we talked about it for a while, we thought, you know, there seems to be an opportunity here to create something that would be useful for us and our friends that was focused more on starting with, you know, who are you going to be with? Where are you going to be? What situation are you in? And what, you know, environment are you looking for? What experience are you looking for? And then sort of backing into the best restaurant recommendation, starting with, you know, with those parameters first, rather than maybe who's the best chef in town or what new exciting restaurants are there. It really, really was built around being situational.
That's so interesting. So Hillary, when did you get involved with the company?
I joined the company almost exactly 4 years ago in 2014. I had been at BuzzFeed for a couple of years before that, not writing about restaurants, but a native New Yorker, loved restaurants and loved eating in them and knew the city really well. And so, it's been about 4 years.
Tell me about the tone. That's part of the whole package. As editor-in-chief, what's the tone of The Infatuation?
Number one thing is we are always honest. We don't go to openings. We don't accept free meals. We use fake names when we go to restaurants. So it's all about being completely honest. And that's the number one thing. It's what would you really say to your friends? How would you write an email to your friends? Another word that we use that we talk about a lot is irreverence. We are funny. We like to keep it entertaining. And really all of our writing falls somewhere in the spectrum between entertaining and useful. Ideally, with elements of both.
With a thin layer of snark ever?
Sure.
Like a buttery film?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk a lot about as well the fact that it just at its core, we hope that the reviews and guides are very relatable and conversational, because I think that's what we kind of found was missing from the existing restaurant reviews and restaurant discovery platforms out there was just the sense that you connected to it. and that you felt like it was a friend that was giving you the advice, maybe rather than an expert or rather than someone that sort of existed in the industry. So the humor part of it really it's really a way to relate the content to the audience and to the community. And that's an important part of it for us.
Now, what's the text back feature? How does that work?
Yeah, so Hillary and I actually, when we were, I think it was 2015, when we were trying to figure out our strategy around building this thing. So basically, you know, just a little more background. It had been a hobby since, you know, from 2009 to 2014. Hillary was our first hire. And so we needed to figure out how are we going to build this and expand it and grow it. And we really wanted to have a one-to-one relationship with the audience. So we thought about texting as a great way to not only serve people with the content, but just to really create that one-to-one relationship. So we went to the Apple store one day, bought an iPhone, connected it to two computers, and put up a splash page and launched what we called TextRex. So it's a platform via which you can text us for restaurant recommendations, and it's all human powered. So at first the humans were Hillary and I, and basically.
So I mean, in the Wayback Machine, if I had texted, I really need a place to take my niece who's a tween.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anything. It could be anything from I'm on 14th Street and I'm with a friend who is gluten-free. Or my parents are coming to town and they only like these specific foods. Or I have a business meeting and this is my budget and my boss really wants me to impress them. People get really specific with it and that is one of the most fun parts of it. And that's really informed a lot of the way that we've come up with our content ideas from that. It was always meant, you know, we were always happy to give recommendations, but it also helped us understand our audience so well. It helped us understand what they actually really wanted. And in ways small and large, from what neighborhoods they were spending time in to what sorts of situations they found themselves in.
I went down a rabbit hole on the infatuation yesterday because I was going to Westville to meet a friend last night. And there is, if you like Westville, here are some other restaurants for you. And everyone was like, oh, that looks good. Oh, that looks like me.
Exactly.
I thought, get out of my head, you guys.
Exactly. Well, it's so funny you say that because we hear that a lot from people. And so much of it comes from our ability to take the, you know, insights that we find from the texting platform, which really just tend to represent a sample size of the larger audience. So the Westville thing is a perfect example where people would text us and say, hey, what's a place like Westville but isn't Westville? And that was exactly where the guide came from. And so we've just found that process to be really useful for us, where we look at the trends we see in the texting platform and say, okay, this is probably something that the rest of the audience is trying to figure out as well. So let's create that guide to serve the audience on the whole.
All right, so here's one. Let's from the infatuation, a guide to the super cute, reasonably priced restaurant to catch up with a few friends.
It's a mouthful.
So that was a guide that came directly from TextRex. We started hearing people all the time asking for, I want something casual, not too expensive, to catch up with a friend. It's really that Tuesday night restaurant.
The Tuesday restaurant.
And this was kind of a fun, you could say Tuesday night restaurant, but this was something that different people were hitting on all those words and saying, yes, that is me. And we sort of wrote the guide without knowing what the reaction would be. And the reaction was huge of all these people writing into us saying, thank you. This is actually exactly what I was looking for. I love knowing about, you know, they're interested in knowing about fine dining restaurants here and there as well. But these guides really spoke to them in a way that was impacting their Tuesday, Wednesday, mm-hmm. Thursday nights.
And I think there's a really important part to that, which is that it's also written with the exact same words that the community was giving to us when they were asking the questions, right?
Oh, so that's what somebody said.
Super yeah, I mean, cute. It was the conversation started with Hillary saying, you know, because we were looking at all these trends all the time, and it would be as simple sometimes as where do I find lunch in Union Square? But Hillary, we were talking about it a bunch where she would say, you know, I'm just seeing people text a lot, some version of these, hey, I'm looking for a cute place that's affordable or a super cute place. And so she just said to me one day, hey, I kind of want to write this guide called the Super Cute Affordable, you know, Place to Catch Up with Friends Guide. And and here we are. And it worked so well. And I think some of that's because it was so relatable, because it was really written in the same words that the audience were using when they were asking for it. So
yeah, this was not a brainstorm. This was a visceral reaction where I was saying, God, if one more person asks for this, it's driving me crazy in a funny way that how do we answer this? And we wrote that guide and people were like, yes, this is the thing I was looking for.
How do you ensure that the guide is diverse culturally, diverse in terms of ethnicity? How is there a way to do that?
It really is about our writers making sure that they are visiting all parts of the city. Our the guides we write are drawn from the reviews and research. We never include a place that we haven't been. So as we've expanded our team, we've put a lot of focus on making sure that we are covering more places in more neighborhoods to grow our audience and be as representative as mm-hmm. possible. So as we grow, we have a bigger group of places to choose from. So I think, you know, we definitely aim to hit all those different elements in our guides and in our sort of site at large.
All right, guys. I have to say, I enjoyed learning about all those places like Westville. I've got a list of places to go now.
Shoot some texts our way. We'll take care of you.
Thanks so much. It's Chris Stang and Hillary Reinsberg, editor-in-chief of the Infatuation and CEO of The Infatuation. Thanks for joining us on All of It.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll meet you on the other side of the break.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.